We'll call this meeting of the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, March 4th. I think we're going to hold off on the minutes until at least we have three members here from the committee. We have one agenda item today, and that is an overview of the Environmental Protection Agency's Clean Power Plan under Section 111D of the Clean Air Act. I think we just got done with the floor session here, so I want to make sure we hear from our testifiers, but at the same time, I don't want to start the presentation too early, so I think what we're going to do is I'm going to recess the committee for just a couple of minutes just to make sure no members get here. Mr. Thornton, if you want to come up to the table, or excuse me, Mr. Thornton? Okay, Mr. Thornton, why don't you come to the table, and like I said, we're just going to temporarily recess the committee just for just until we get a couple more members here so that... Yeah, load up your PowerPoint presentation. So, members, we're in a very, very brief recess, so don't leave because we'll be starting, though. Thanks.
I don't know how to do it.
Sweet, leaving.
Yeah, whatever you need.
I need to restart the computer.
Do
you have a flash drive? Oh, I thought they brought it and it's loaded. Is this your computer? Whoever printed it out,
I do have a copy for everybody.
I don't think that's relative to age.
Well, you're the background.
How many kids do you have?
Four.
What age is it?
Six, four, three, and eight. Only four.
How is it to be a grandparent? That's where I'm headed. I don't
care. Oh, he knew that Neuberger was a... That's always nice to have an EMT around.
In 9 days, I'm...
Yeah, it's warm. You got to move slower.
Thank you.
With the flash drive, is it E?
So she can do that.
Yeah. She's responsible for the cost of her own matter. Wow.
Does she have a retainer with you?
Thank you.
My oldest still has my credit card. We use for bail.
That's all your aunts and uncles for.
Well, that was my role. No, she's been arrested, I think, three times.
No problem.
Once it occupied.
Sure, no problem.
Once you change yourself to the door, that's the...
Well?
What's the FDA?
15 plus minutes without questions.
FDA.
Nose whip. It's pretty complicated. Probably questions along the way would be...
1% is needed to see his weight.
Without questions, it's about 15 minutes. Okay.
I think it's 12 regions.
I tell you what, though. If I say something that nobody's going to understand...
Don't let me know. The average jobs out there...
Yeah, sometimes if you start
What's on here?
Right.
Yeah,
there we go.
And dancing slides.
All right, we got to here now.
I think any key will work, but
right here.
You can get that D.
All right. Are you ready?
I am.
Are we ready to go again? Okay. Representative Matisse is in the room, so we'll now take the committee back from recess. Representative Wagenius moves approval of the minutes dated Monday, March 2nd. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. And again, members, the one item on our agenda today is an overview of the 111D implementation plan. I recognize the fact that there may be many members who have strong opinions in favor or against the 111D rule, but I think it's just important that members for today, instead of advocating or opposing it, that we focus on what it is these rules do and understanding their significance to Minnesota. Public comment has already been done by the PCA in terms of suggestions. Those comments have been given to the EPA for proposed rules, and the final rule, I believe, they're looking at the summer coming out with. So again, let's talk about understanding what it is that this rule does. Mr. Representative Mahoney, before we go to Mr. Thornton, did you have a comment or a question?
Yes, I just have a question. I was looking at the testifiers, and I'm just wondering, is there anyone in favor of these rules on the testifiers? It looks like they're all power companies. The chamber, which we know gets along so well with its power companies.
Representative Mahoney, today it's not a matter of whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, as I said in my comments. I don't know if the MPCA has taken a position on it. They're our first testifiers. But once we, I think we'll be able to get through these testifiers pretty quick. If there's members of the public who wish to testify, if we have time, we'll take it up. So welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And I'm happy to give you an overview of EPA's Clean Power Plan, also known as their proposal for greenhouse gas emission standards of performance for existing fossil fuel electric generating units under Section 111D of the Clean Air Act. That's a lot of words. I'm going to try to keep this as understandable as possible, but I'm going to count on the chair to catch me if I say things that are going to be confusing to most of you. EPA, to set a little bit of broad context, the administration has developed what they're calling their plan for addressing climate change, and there's four major parts to it. Reducing carbon pollution from power plants and building cars that use less fuels, cutting energy waste from our homes and business, helping states and cities prepare for the impact of climate change, and leading global efforts to address climate change. And what we're here to talk about is the very first part of that, the power plant. EPA has already done some rules addressing the fuel efficiency of motor vehicles, and they've done a pretty good job of addressing that. They've also proposed standards of performance for new fossil fuel plants. The final for that rule is due this summer. It primarily affects new coal plants. We don't have, none of our utilities are planning any. We haven't really focused on that, and I wasn't going to really talk about that today. So again, we're talking about the Clean Power Plan for existing plants, also known as 111D. As I said, this applies to existing fossil fuel power plants. Generally, it applies to units that are larger than around 25 megawatts in size, so it doesn't apply to every little unit in the state, but most of them. It establishes state-specific emission targets.
Mr. Thornton, someone brought up a suggestion to me. I heard a little voice in my head that maybe you should just explain what 111D signifies, so when we refer to it as 111D, people know what that means.
111D is a section of the Clean Air Act that requires EPA to establish standards of performance for existing facilities when a pollutant has been identified and is considered to be an air pollutant.
Thank you.
And so they are now beginning to roll out regulations for greenhouse gases. The first thing they did was motor vehicle controls. The second thing they did was standards of performance for new power plants, which is 111B of the Clean Air Act, and what everyone is most focused on is this section 111D, which is standards of performance for existing facilities. It establishes state-specific emission targets that are different for each state based on unique conditions within those states, and ultimately the states are responsible for developing plans that they have to submit to EPA for achieving those emission targets. EPA has stated that their overall goal is that this plan nationally would reduce utility sector CO2 emissions by 30% by 2030, and they're using 2005 as a baseline for that. They have identified, as required by this section of the Clean Air Act, what they believe constitutes a best system of emission reductions to apply to the existing fossil fuel units. They actually pointed out Minnesota as a model for this because of the existing statutes and policies that we have in place that have done quite a job in cleaning up our utility industry and the efforts of our utilities. And the proposal allows a great deal of flexibility for compliance. In establishing the state-by-state emission targets, they actually used 2012 as a baseline year. They did this because that was the most recent year that they had a complete set of data and information about the performance of plants around the country to use. I'll mention why that's an issue in a minute. They set, for each state, emission rate targets that are expressed in terms of pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour. States are required to meet an interim target reduction by 2020 and maintain that through 2029, and then they're required to meet their final reduction target by 2030 and beyond. 2012 is of concern because a lot of actions have taken place in Minnesota to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from utilities, and most of those took place prior to 2012. So using 2012 as a baseline creates an issue that people have referred to as not getting credit for early action.
And Mr. Thornton, could you just highlight maybe one or two of those actions that we have taken just to familiarize members of the committee with what Minnesota's investments were?
Well, one excellent example is retiring the Highbridge plant, which burned coal, and replacing it with a natural gas plant.
Please continue. Let's just, I would really, okay, I'm asking questions, so I suppose I should let the committee. Representative, did you want to finish your point before I go to Representative Wagenius? You were talking about...
Well, I just said one excellent example is the fact that Xcel Energy retired the Highbridge coal plant and replaced it with natural gas.
Okay, Representative Wagenius to that point.
Well, about the same time they did the Riverside plant in Minneapolis, too, a little bit before that, but my recollection that the reason we did that was for fine particulates and not for carbon. I don't think we were doing it for carbon.
Mr.
Thornton.
Chairman, committee members.
President Wagenius. Mr. Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, committee members. I think that the main driver and concern at the time was air pollution and fine particulate matter. But certainly reduction in greenhouse gases was a major co-benefit that was a result of those actions. So this is an overview of how EPA establishes each state's individual target for reduction. It's fairly complicated. It took us, the proposal came out last June, and it took us more than 2 months to sort of understand it. So I will be going through this a couple of different ways, but it's very important to understand that these building blocks that you see at the bottom are simply how they calculated each state's target. They are not prescriptive as to how the state wants to or should meet the target. So we can do whatever we want in order to meet the target. It's the target that's really the goal. And here they take a calculation that relates to coal units in the state, which is referred to as the first block, natural gas units, the second block. The third block they refer to as zero emission power, and it relates to renewable energy and some nuclear. And then the final block, the fourth block, is energy efficiency or demand side management. And I'm going to go through each one of these quickly to explain how they made each state's calculation. For the coal units, they took 2012 heat rates, how efficient the coal units in your state were in terms of pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour. They looked at how much those coal units were being used. And then they assumed that each unit would be able to achieve some heat rate efficiencies of approximately 6% across the board and calculated your coal unit target based on that. couple of issues to point out here. A lot of the coal units in Minnesota have already undergone heat rate improvements, so there may not be a whole lot more to squeeze out. And it's not clear that 6% is achievable across the board anyway. But those are the assumptions that EPA made in how this works. Another problem in Minnesota in particular, in 2012, Sherco 3, our largest coal unit, was offline for the entire year because of a turbine accident. And so it's not calculated into this block at all, and that makes a big difference in terms of our target. It makes our target more stringent. I'll get into the comments that we've made to EPA about that in just a minute. The second block is natural gas units. It basically applies to combined cycle units. And the target assumes that a state could run all of its natural gas units at 70% capacity. And in theory, that would reduce the amount of capacity needed from coal-fired units. As an example, in 2012, our state units were running at around 23-24% capacity. And new units, anything that's built from now on out, is not included in this calculation. There are a couple of issues with this. First of all, our gas units don't run at 70% capacity. They haven't needed to do that. They were basically built for intermediate load or peaking load capacity, and in some cases to follow wind. And that's another concern, is that a lot of them were intended to follow wind. So this relates to another comment that we've made to EPA.
Before we go to block, are you done with block two or no?
I am.
Before you go to block three, Representative Hortman has a question.
A question on block one. When you referred to the term heat rates, can you say a little bit more about heat rates?
That's essentially how efficient a coal-fired power plant is in terms of getting energy out from the amount of coal that's being burned there. So heat rate improvements mean the kind of things that utilities do for that are to perhaps put in a more efficient turbine, put in more efficient pumps and piping, and basically taking the structure, the skeleton of their power plant, and adding a few things on or replacing a few things that end up being more efficient in terms of the operation.
Representative Hartman.
So the different from capacity factor in terms of the heat output of the coal?
Heat rate improvement is improving the way it runs, regardless of how often it's running.
Representative Hortman.
It's like taking a 30-mile-per-gallon car and putting something else under the hood so you get 34 miles per gallon.
Right. Good analogy. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious, would you have to be running those natural gas plants for like base load rather than peaking? Is that the difference between the 24 and the 70%?
Mr. Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, essentially that would be what you would have to do if you chose to run your natural gas units at 70% in order to comply. But as I've said, you don't have to do that to comply. You can comply in any way you want. Which gets us to block three, the zero emission sources. For the purposes of this block, EPA calculated every state's target by taking a regional average of the renewable energy standards for the states in that region. So each region of the country has a different target for this block. For the upper Midwest states, we have Minnesota at 25 by 25. We have, I think, North Dakota at nothing, and the other states have different numbers. And so when you add them all up, the average was 15%. So this block assumes that we'll be achieving 15% of our energy from renewable energy by 2030. And as you know, we already exceed that, so this block helps us a lot. EPA decided not to include large existing hydro, and the main reason from that, I understand, is because it resulted in some pretty strange outcomes for a number of the western states that have really large hydro dams. And they also included a penalty for at-risk nuclear. They define at-risk nuclear as nuclear plants that are likely to retire between now and 2030. We don't have any of those in Minnesota, but they decided to penalize every state with nuclear capacity as an incentive to keep those at-risk nuclears running past 2030.
When you say penalty, Commissioner, I apologize for interrupting, Commissioner, but for when you say penalty, please explain what that
Mr.
means.
Mr. Chairman, what I mean is it makes our target a little bit more stringent.
You have to, if you have a at-risk nuclear facility, your pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour is lower.
If you have any nuclear facility in your state, your pounds of CO2 are lower, which makes their application of this all the more mysterious.
But my understanding, sorry, and I don't mean, Representative Fabian's got a question, but I want to make sure if I'm misunderstanding this. I thought that if there was a place where there was a nuclear power plant that was scheduled to be decommissioned, that what was going to happen is you have two scenarios. Nuclear power plant, two states exactly the same, state A, state B. State A has a nuclear power plant. It's not scheduled to be decommissioned. State B, everything else is the exact same, but they got a nuclear power plant that's supposed to be decommissioned in 2020. The CO2 targets for state B on pounds per megawatt hour, CO2 pounds per megawatt hour, are lower than state A. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, they reduced the target for both of those states. They did not specifically focus on the states that they thought actually had the at-risk nuclear power, which again makes this part of their proposal even more mysterious.
Okay. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Thornton, thank you for being here. Back to Block 1 just for a minute, if we could, please. You stated that the Sherco 3 plant was down for the entire year, and that had made, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it increased some of the things that we're going to have to do. It's going to make it more difficult for us. Is there any mechanism in the EPA proposed rules, 111D, that allows for some sort of an appeal to what they are proposing?
Commissioner Zarden.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, EPA actually asked for some comments on that, and we gave them a couple of ways that they could fix that problem. We told them that they could use just an average capacity factor for that plant from previous years and plug it in as a fix for that one anomalous issue. The other thing that EPA asked for comment on was whether or not using a three-year average instead of just that 1 year 2012 would be appropriate. And I think either approach helps a lot and will address the concerns that we have about that.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Thornton, so just to be clear, where is the state of Minnesota with regards to those options? What steps are we taking?
Well,
Commissioner
Mr. Chairman, committee members, we specifically commented on that in our formal comments that we submitted to EPA, and our preferred option is that they plug in a number for Sherco 3 that represents its general operating conditions.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, when you say we, who is we?
Commissioner Stein from the Pollution Control Agency. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Stein from the Pollution Control Agency and Commissioner Rothman from the Department of Commerce.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to be clear, has Governor Dayton, does he have a position on this?
Commissioner Thornton.
I haven't talked to Governor Dayton about this. I don't.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so we're going to let the commissioner finish up, and then Representative Wagenius, you'll be first on the list. So, Commissioner Thornton.
Okay, now we're at Block 4, which is kind of easy. This is the energy efficiency block. It assumes that states can achieve 1.5% per year improvement in energy efficiency. So for Minnesota, that means we're pretty much there as it is. It means we have to stay there. For states that aren't there, they have to ramp up to it. So this block, in terms of our calculation, our calculated target is fairly neutral with respect to the state. So. Putting it all together and running the math without actually doing that in front of you here, it's you add the targets from all of those little blocks up, and we start with Minnesota's base emission rate in 2012 of 1,470 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour. Based on EPA's proposal, our 2020 target is 911 pounds of CO2, and our 2030 target is 873 pounds. So most of the reductions have to occur between now and 2020, which is pretty quick when you're talking about changes in utility system operations and assets. And our 2030 goal represents about a 41% reduction from current levels, which is, if you recall, I said that EPA's target was to get a 30% reduction nationally from 2005 levels. Well, if you look around the country, our target is more aggressive than many states. And there are a lot of states that have targets that are much less aggressive than that. In fact, in our region, the neighboring states, Iowa and North Dakota's targets are less than 20% reduction, and South Dakota and Wisconsin's are in the 30% range. So not only have we already done a lot, and we're, as the way they've constructed this, not going to get a lot of credit for some of that, they are giving us a fairly aggressive target, and one that's more aggressive than our neighbors. So one of the things we pointed out in our comments is that there are some equity issues here, and I don't know why this is logging off.
We ran out of power. Whoa. No, I'm just kidding.
Maybe Excel didn't like something I said.
They do have the big red switch. I've seen it.
I've got a question.
Oh, just hold on one sec here.
I'll struggle on without it. You have the handouts in front of you, I think.
We need a
charger. And maybe if it comes back on, we can get back to it. So as I was saying, our reduction target is more aggressive than a lot of states. It's certainly above average. It's more aggressive than our neighboring states, and there are some equity issues associated with this. And we think EPA needs to look at how they can balance this proposal a little bit better so that it's less inequitable. We frankly were hoping that this would sort of raise the playing field up so that everybody was operating more under the same rules, sort of leveling the playing field, and that's not exactly what happened with this. We recognize that states are starting it from different places, but still it just feels a little off to us. So the next slide is major issues and comments, and I've got a couple of slides on this. This summarizes the kind of comments that we submitted to EPA in our comment letter in mid-December. We told them that, oh, by the way, EPA received 4 million comments on this. Now, a lot of them were very similar, but still, they've got a lot of work to do. They've hired contractors just to read them and sort them. We told them that this represents good progress. We support looking at ways to improve the emissions profile from the utility industry. We told them that there are some equity issues that concern us. That we are concerned that it doesn't fully recognize all the actions that have already been taken in Minnesota, and we want them to do some rebalancing of this proposal. But at the same time, we don't want them to weaken the overall effect nationally. We talked about the fact that our target is more aggressive than neighboring states. We talked about how we were not satisfied with their treatment of early action. We talked about Sherco 3 being offline in 2012, and we gave them some specific fixes for making that better. We also found out that they have some data wrong about our natural gas units. And when you correct those data problems and add something in for Sherco 3, it makes a difference on our target. There are some lack of clarity regarding how renewable energy counts for states. You might know that some of Minnesota's renewable energy is located in North Dakota, and we asked for some clarity that renewable energy credits should belong to the states or the utilities that paid for them. The same thing with energy efficiency. We told them that we felt like energy efficiency credits should belong to the people that paid for them. I mentioned that our 2020 reduction target was fairly aggressive, and we asked that they allow states to submit alternative glide paths that are more in sync with their states and utilities' integrated resource plans so that the transition to this target in 2030 could be much smoother. Oddly enough, EPA's proposal would not count any actions taken between now and 2020. So if we were to build new renewable energy between now and 2020, it wouldn't count. And we think that's not smart. And so we suggested that they should let those actions count. We also, EPA made it sound like any new major hydro projects would count, and we wanted them to clarify that a Canadian hydro project would count, because we have utilities that are looking towards that, and that would help our help us meet our reduction target. We suggested they drop nuclear power from this whole calculation, and we told them that we feel like blocks 2 and 3 are connected, that the more wind power you build, the more you use natural gas to back it up, and to not connect those two boxes is a mistake. We think that EPA is going to make the data corrections that I alluded to. We expect them to clarify that renewable energy credits will belong to the people that paid for them. We're not sure about how they're going to address energy efficiency or Canadian hydro. We expect nuclear power to get fixed. And we do expect some balancing to occur to address the concerns that we've raised about that, but I have no idea how they're going to do it and to what degree that they would do it. In terms of what the PCA or the state has to do in order to demonstrate compliance with this, I mentioned that we have a lot of flexibility. We don't have to implement those blocks exactly as they are laid out. We can forget natural gas block and overbuild renewable power and use that as our primary means of complying with this, or combinations thereof. But we have a lot of flexibility. We can take EPA's target that we get and apply it to each unit, which would be the least flexible way to go.
Everyone, there's a button here. We got a wireless device. I don't hear it anymore, but all right, please continue, Commissioner.
We can apply unit-specific limits to each unit, apply the same limit to every unit. That would be the least flexible way, because it doesn't recognize the performance differences between the units. We can give each utility within the state a target and let them average the performance between their different units in order to meet that target. We can take our target as a state whole target and allocate it to the different utilities and do some statewide averaging in order to meet the target. We can convert it from a rate to a mass, from pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour to tons of CO2, and allocate tons. And oddly enough, EPA has allowed for a fairly wide range of possible multi-state compliance options as well, envisioning that more than one state would get together and work out some kind of an arrangement about how they were going to implement their targets. The plans, EPA is supposed to get their final proposal out midsummer. They're not quite specific about what day. Keeping in mind what they said in their proposal, that means we have a year to get our plan in. It's possible to get a year extension if we meet certain conditions in terms of the specificity with which our first submittal to them meets. And if you go into if you work with other states and submit some kind of a joint thing, you can get another year extension. The plan must be permanent. It must be verifiable. and it must be enforceable. So probably most of you are asking, so what does this mean? How are we going to get there? How hard is it going to be? Well, it's hard to answer because we don't have the final number. And the proposed number that they gave us, we expect to change, and we don't exactly know which direction. But there's a lot of things going on in the state that we can be proud of and that are going to help us do this. Utilities are continuing to install renewable energy. They are continuing to pursue energy efficiency options. There are a number of coal plant retirements that are already planned that will be able to count for this. Almost every time people revise their forecast for demand, it gets changed a little bit. So our best estimate at this point is that EPA's target is going to be achievable for us. I can't say we're right on track to get there, but we think it's achievable, and we think we've got the programs in place to help us get there. We have been meeting with stakeholders for 2 years now, talking about this. We have regrouped our stakeholder effort and had a meeting a couple of weeks ago. There are about 50 people involved. We asked them what we should be thinking about as we're beginning to work on this. And the top three priorities they gave us were be mindful of the cost, be mindful of reliability, and make sure that we achieve environmental results.
Commissioner, thank you very much for the presentation on a very complex and obviously very provocative and controversial issue. And I appreciate you presenting it in a way that I think legislators can understand. So, members, we have other testifiers, but we do have quite a few members' questions. I would just remind members to ask your question, not make a statement with it. If members get long-winded, we're just going to stop stop questioning, and we're just going to move on with testifiers. So, Representative Lagunas, we'll start with you.
Chair, let's assume the rebalancing, and I'm glad to hear you think things are going to go in a good way. But if they were a little off and it was harder for us, is there any way to say that we will do better in one of the other big categories and that would compensate for this category, like transportation? That was a fairly short question.
Very good, Representative Gaines. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members, the best I can say is maybe. The EPA has opened a crack for outside of utility strategies, the possibility for them to count. And so we're going to have to keep our eyes open for that.
Representative Metza, then Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I and Commissioner, would we be in a competitive disadvantage at all regionally compared to our neighbors with our larger industry, whether it be agriculture, mining, paper, in terms of having a gap in the goals for each neighboring state? How long would it take to even out so we're on a level playing field?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members, that's a really good question, and it's one of the reasons why we commented about the equity concerns that we had. But it's hard to know because the power is dispatched regionally, and we don't. It's just really hard to know. It's possible that Commissioner Grant might want to step up and help answer some of these questions, or maybe some of the utility people. I'm guessing he doesn't want to get up and answer some questions.
It's a difficult, and of course, we're dealing in a static technology situation right now.
Let me just say this. It'll be one of the things that we think about with our stakeholders as we plow through this and try to figure out what's the smartest plan for Minnesota to submit on this. And, you know, one thing we are, I failed to mention this, but one thing we are doing is engaging conversations with other states. Because, in theory, the more people you get into solving the problem, the less expensive it's going to be. and the more you can spread the equity out. I don't know that that's the approach that we're going to take. I don't know that we're going to find any other state that wants to work with us. It may be too complicated to work it out. There's a whole bunch of things in the way, but we're at least continuing to converse with other states to see if that's an opportunity.
Representative Metza, is it quick, or can we go to
real
citizens?
Point, yeah.
Go ahead, Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was wondering if you get a chance, you know, as these things are going on, if you could give cost per taxpayer, you know, for Minnesota comparative to the other states and implementing our plan versus the others, and share that with maybe myself and committee.
Thank you, Representative Metzger. Representative Swazinski, then Neuberger, or maybe not, Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Commissioner. Just kind of a question kind of going about, you talked about the reduction from Iowa and percentage of reduction, but you didn't really kind of go into the areas of where they were, kind of their base was at. So according to your list on 2012 was 1470 pounds per CO2, and then you talked about reduction and what we were looked at from that point, even though considering Sherco is offline, but you talked about other states. Where are they at when we talk about reduction and what they're planned from reduction standpoint? And then my second question that we can answer is you're going for investments that we've made in North Dakota when it comes to wind energy and the renewable side of that. Did they do also a calculation on imported, so if we've got imported coal energy coming through, did we get credited for that or discounted for that? You know, if we're looking to get a positive from the wind side, are we going to get a negative from the other side then?
Commissioner?
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'll answer the second question first. The coal plants in North Dakota belong to North Dakota. The coal plants in Minnesota belong to Minnesota. I think EPA is going to decide that the wind in North Dakota that we bought belongs to us. I think that's just the reality of how they're going to let this all settle out. With respect to where other states are starting from, everybody's obviously starting in a different place. We've already made some improvements in Minnesota, so our emission rate, that 1,400-something, is lower than a lot of states. States that have a lot of natural gas resources, like Louisiana and Texas, they're already lower than that, and they have to go lower still. So I'd be happy to get you a listing of those numbers for the different states, but just for our region. Okay, I can do that.
So, Commissioner, you think the EPA is going to give us credit for the wind energy we bought that was produced in North Dakota, but the coal energy we buy from North Dakota is going to get hit on – North Dakota is going to get hit for it?
In a word, yes.
Well, I thought North Dakota hated us before. They're really going to hate us after this. Okay. Well, Representative Swazinski, were you done? Representative Swazinski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just don't make a comment about their capital.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Just had two really quick questions. I apologize for coming in a little late to this. This is kind of my area that I'm really interested in, and I've been really tearing into the proposed rules here, the Clean Power Plan rules and the 111D stuff, and I heard you talking about it. I'm very familiar with the delays that we've had, especially with Sherco 3, and then also with some of the counting some of the renewables. I understand that there's some confusion, and we haven't been given a final number yet. And going through the rules here, you had alluded to this, that we've got until June 30th, basically, of 2016. But as you alluded to, that there is a condition in here that if a state has I won't read the rule to you, but if the state has an issue or if there are problems coming up with those targets or coming up with their plan, that they can file for a one-year extension, which would push us into June 30th of 2017. Given the uncertainty of what we're dealing with right now, and because we really don't have a final number, is it your intention to file for a one-year extension to 2017?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members, we're moving full speed ahead. We're going to try to get everything done in 1 year, but frankly, I don't think we'll make it. For one reason, we'll probably have to go into rulemaking, and that we can't do that in a year. So I think the reality is that we'll probably need to file for that extension. What we don't know for sure at this point is what EPA is going to need in order to successfully get an extension. We're hoping that they'll clarify that in their whatever they come out with this summer.
Representative Neuberger, your second question?
Thank you. The other question I had was, you were talking about meeting with stakeholders. Is, you said there were about 50. Would you be willing to provide the committee here a list of who those stakeholders are? You can just email it to us at another time. That'd be great. I'd love to have that. And with that, I'm.
Thank you, Representative. And Commissioner, just logistically speaking, a decision to seek a one-year extension, who makes that decision? I mean, who is authorized to make that determination?
The state implementation plan is submitted by the governor on behalf of the governor by the commissioner of the PCA.
Representative Baker, and then we're going to Mr. IHLE, I'm mispronouncing the name, I don't want to butcher, just want to come down and get ready to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Thornton. A new legislator here, so I'm kind of wondering about the MPCA's leadership philosophy when it comes to some of these new rules you're working with, the 111D, and how this is all coming together. When you're in the leadership committee and you guys are talking with the other commissioners in the MPCA, and I see that Minnesota now is 30th on the list of industrial commercial electric rates, do you guys get down to the concern of how competitive we are as well when it comes to your positions and things that you will accept for what is probably right for Minnesota and having that balance, or is it not so much your philosophy to talk about that? Because for a lot of Minnesotans, it's important. So I want to know, what is the MPCA's philosophy when it comes to just what is reasonable when they're determining what that level of numbers should be? Thank you.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, well, keep in mind that EPA is going to set the bar for us here. So our job will be to try to figure out how to get to that bar in the way that's best for Minnesota. And I can assure you that cost, total cost to ratepayers, cost to individuals is going to be one of the things that we're going to focus on.
And one follow-up, just what if you don't agree with the EPA? What if you say that number is not right? What is the fallback if you say you just don't agree and there's an impasse? What would happen then?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members, I think if it's about how they calculated the number using the formula that they had, I think there's an opportunity for us to argue with them about which data goes in to make the formula work. I think if it's a more substantial argument with how they put it together in general, probably the only opportunity that we would have to challenge it would be to take them to court.
Commissioner, thank you very much.
What?
Oh, Mr. Ela?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted a chance to respond to Representative Baker's question. There's an existing statute with respect to the Pollution Control Agency that I think speaks to it a little bit, and it's probably a good thing for all committee members to know, not only with respect to what we're our subject today, but to the PCA in general. And what that says is, quote, in exercising all its powers, the Pollution Control Agency shall give due consideration to the establishment, maintenance, operation, and expansion of business, commerce, trade, industry, traffic, and other economic factors and other material matters affecting the feasibility and practicability of any proposed action. So to some extent, that's within the philosophy of the Pollution Control Agency in everything that it does.
Thank you, Mr. Ela. And Commissioner,
Chair,
thank you again for your presentation. I know it's a very complex subject matter. I think this committee could just focus on 111D for 4 months. It's so complicated, but I appreciate the way you've formulated the data and shared it with us. Thank you very much, and look forward to working with you with us. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Jack Eiley. I'm Director of Environmental Policy for Xcel Energy.
Please continue.
Okay, thank you. I'll be fairly brief. A lot of what we will say actually echoes what David Thornton already offered to the committee today. I didn't bring a presentation, so XL Energy can't stop me from making a presentation on behalf of XL Energy.
Are you a member of the
chamber? Please continue. One thing I'd share with Mr. Thornton's view about the rules, it's a bit difficult to be conclusive about a lot of this right now. At this moment, we're now sort of winding down what I would call our federal advocacy period. The comments were actually due in early December. There is some ability to influence EPA, so I did want to talk about that a little bit and then talk about our preliminary views on state plans, which is the next step. This rule, as with many environmental rules, has a strong federal component in where the rule is proposed and finalized, but then the states actually have a very significant role in implementation, as was already alluded to. So our basic position on this proposed rule is multifaceted. There are certainly some legal concerns that we have raised in our comments. I don't want to speak to that. I'm not an attorney, and it's almost its own realm. It's the legal debate about this rule. It's a pretty expansive rule, encompassing a lot of elements of energy policy in this environmental policy objective. On the positive side, one of the things that we asked EPA for, and we have been talking to them for about 2 years before they even proposed the rule. We wanted to work with them because we had such an interesting environmental portfolio at this company, is the ability to use your utility portfolio to comply with this rule over across a broad set of emissions reduction actions. The rule actually does offer that. As we heard earlier, you don't have to achieve the individual blocks in their individual prescriptions. You just have to achieve the target number. So we do think that's positive. There are other elements of flexibility. They did offer a 10-year interim baseline, for instance, that has the potential to be flexible. I call it potential flexibility. I'll get into some of our concerns with the rule and explain what that means a little bit better. Our chief concern with the rule, and David alluded to that already, is the lack of early action credit in this rule. Through things like the Metro Emission Reduction Program, where we did retire two coal plants and put in two natural gas combined cycle generators, the rule became more stringent as a result of the actions that we and others in the state undertook. And that's a real significant problem. And the way that the wind works is positive in some respects, but you can look at it in different ways. And we actually think that without some of those actions, which in a way were done to increase the energy diversity in the state and were done to reduce emissions, instead of an 873 pounds per megawatt hour target in 2030, we would have been somewhere over 1,100 pounds per megawatt hour in 2030. That's sort of us reverse calculating an alternative outcome under this rule, which we have in our comments. So that's a primary concern of ours. The other aspect, and we also share the Sherco concerns very strongly, of course. That's a baseline issue. A lot of this early action problem centers around the baseline. EPA started in 2012 very, very directly. If you looked at the headlines in June, in that first week of June, you would have concluded that they used the 2005 baseline, but they did not. They used a 2012 baseline. There is no 2005 data anywhere in the rule. So that's where the early action problem comes in, is that they've ignored our actions since 2005, such as our 22% or 23% carbon reduction since 2005, heading towards 30% by 2030 on our NSP system. The other central problem that we have with the rule is what's called the interim target, or sometimes it's referred to as a cliff problem. To give you an example of that, the reduction target is a 41% reduction from that 1470 number that we heard earlier to the 873 number. The interim target is 911 pounds, so that's a 38% reduction, and that's in that first period from 2020 to 2029. You don't have to literally hit 911 pounds in 2020, but you have to get pretty close because those two numbers are quite close and you have a 10-year average. So if you would actually be much above 911 in 2020, you'd probably get below the final target below 2030. So we think that flexibility, this is what I meant by potential flexibility, the fact that interim target is so close to the final target actually renders some of the potential flexibility unusable. And we think that EPA needs to address that target, or that interim target, for Minnesota and for many other states. So those are two big federal advocacy pieces. Moving into the state area, We just wanted to mention what we see, and it's very early days in that. And David alluded to a lot of the potential pathways that the state could choose, and you know, we're honestly looking at all those, you know, in a very neutral way at this point. We're trying to understand all of them better. It's a whole other complex area of the rule. We went through all the complexities of the target setting most of the last few months, but the state plan piece is even more complex and unknown. But as we go into that process, we do believe that the state should do a plan. We think it's better for the state to use its local policies to comply with the rule, use its local expertise, the local conditions on the ground. We think that's going to be an overall much better outcome for the state to do it that way, as opposed to having a federal plan imparted on here, which is essentially the alternative. We will absolutely work constructively on the state plan. We want to be an active participant in that process. We do think that all utilities should be at the table and should be participating in the state plan. It's a statewide target, and we think all the actors should be there in that discussion. Some of the challenges of the state plan, the timing is very short between the final rule. So we'll get a final rule midsummer is what EPA says, so I'm guessing August or September. May have to turn in that initial plan June 30th of 2016. Followed by a final plan in 17 or perhaps in 18 if you do regional collaboration. So it's actually a very short timeline. Another challenge is participation. We think that the best and most durable plan has to be politically credible in order to survive, and that means that it has to have all the stakeholders there. We absolutely see a strong role for the environmental regulator, MPCA, but also our economic regulator, the PUC, and the Department of Commerce as well. And that's because these blocks reach far beyond what has been traditional environmental policy, which focuses on emissions reductions out of smokestack. We're getting into DSM, we're getting into renewables, we're getting into redispatch.
I'm sorry, explain what DSM is. Remember?
I'm sorry. That's right. I'm not from here. We call it CIP in Minnesota. So demand side management is sort of a generic term for energy efficiency program efforts. Thank you. Good clarification. And then finally, the complexity of the possibilities under the state plan. Are manifold. You have a number of approaches EPA has suggested as possible pathways. I'm not sure those are comprehensive. I think there may be other ways that a state could suggest how to do this. And then you get into the mass versus rate questions. How do you deal with new units? I think there's a lot of work to do. Do want to commend David and his team and MPCA for kicking off that discussion, because I think there's a lot to work out in terms of how you do a plan. I get to look across eight states in varying degrees and how we do this, and I'm happy to say that Minnesota is, I think, starting that discussion earlier than most of our other states at this point. I do think that's wise. So I will stop there.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Representative Mahoney, then Swazinski, then Hortman. Representative Mahoney.
Me first?
Yes.
You know, I had to step out, so I apologize. But here's my concern. My understanding, and I'm relatively new to the committee, is that the investor-owned utilities have kind of borne the brunt of much of this reduction. So I'm going to ask that question. I don't know if you can answer that in Minnesota. But one of the ways that was alluded to is that they could take the state as a whole, divide the carbon reduction, and assign it to each one, each of the utilities, so the co-ops, the munis, the whomever, maybe probably even cogeneration plants that companies own. But has XL looked at how much they themselves have reduced as opposed to anyone else in the state as a utility?
That's fair.
The main question there is, we do know our emissions reductions. It's 23% through 2013 from 2005 levels, heading towards 30%. And I believe this committee recently heard from our resource planning experts, and we've laid out sort of a pathway toward a 40% by 2030. I don't know the exact breakdown of XL versus all the rest of the state. We were a bit more than half the state in terms of generation emissions and sales. Our reductions are greater than the rest of the state's reductions at this point. I'd be happy to assert that. Numerically, I don't know how much, but I think it's significantly greater than some of the other actors in the state.
Representative Mahoney? I'm sorry. Representative Svitinsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thornton.
No, my name is Mr. Eiley.
Mr. Eiley, sorry. I got messed up earlier. Just a question to you, kind of along the lines of, I think you do work kind of across the country a little bit. You don't just talk about Minnesota issues. Kind of looking kind of at baseline aspect, you know, we're talking about kind of the advancements. You know, Minnesota's kind of getting caught in alerts. We did a lot of early work in the early 2000s. That's not necessarily getting calculated into what our necessarily goal is moving forward. But kind of just along the lines, you know, I've got some larger industry in my district, and they're talking about where Minnesota stands compared to other states. Representative Metza brought up some of the facts. We're talking about paper, talking about mining. Kind of where would you say from a cost basis from your entity we stand in competition?
Mr. Eiley.
I'd say with respect to the other states, it's pretty clear that Minnesota got a more stringent target than the average. To back that up, the overall goal achieves 30% reduction from 2005 by 2030. Minnesota definitely has a more stringent target than that. As far as costs, I mean, there are some costs that we could provide you that EPA actually modeled. They do have state and regional modeling on that. I don't have those with me. I'm happy to provide some data on that. It's very public. We do have it pretty well distilled. Be happy to bring that out. I don't have the numbers here. From our perspective, just from XL, you know, XL Energy and its customers' perspective, it's frustrating to not be able to answer that question because we don't have the final rule and we don't have the state plan. You know, we do have these significant emissions reductions underway, so that final cost would have everything to do with the trajectory of our emissions versus the required targets, which I simply don't know due to the final rule. We are thinking about ways to characterize that range of potential outcomes, but it becomes a little challenging to answer that. But we can get you statewide data if you're interested in that.
Representative Hartman. And by the way, Representative Hartman, before I call on you, I wanted to point out we have a very esteemed guest in our audience today. Former Representative Frank Moe is up over there hiding from the crowd, our colleague from when we were first elected. So very esteemed and respected guest. He insisted that I recognize him to the audience, so that's why.
I just want to call him down and ask how he got the black eye.
I'll give you what dog sledding, of course. So Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two quick questions. One is, what does Xcel propose as a base year for Minnesota, or do you propose a three-year period? Just curious, because I agree we're being penalized because of the base year selected, and we should get credit for the action that mainly you took in the last 8 years. And then is the utility industry nationwide talking about the possibility of carbon offsets or carbon sinks getting credit? My understanding is there'd have to be a change at the federal level, but it seems to me that there could be a partnership between the somewhat ailing forestry industry and the utility industry that's struggling to come up with plans to comply with 111D.
Those are great questions. On the base year, I think I give you about three answers on that. We certainly prefer a 2005 base year because that's when we really intentionally began to reduce emissions and make those coordinated investments working with our stakeholders, as I mentioned a couple times. So we absolutely prefer that. Our conversations with EPA on this, and we've had a lot of them both within trade groups and directly with EPA, with some of the architects of the rule in EPA's headquarters. We've gotten a pretty strong signal that they are not going to simply move the baseline back to 2005, and I would encourage if David or anyone else has any other views on that, but they've been pretty clear that they will not do that. In response to that, and our comments are in pretty good detail on this, and we worked many hours over the summer to develop this, we developed a number of what we call fixes that work within their framework to restore the early action credit we think should be there. Very briefly, one of them is a pretty simple one. We suggested that in cases like the Metro Emission Reduction Project where natural gas combined cycles were put on the very same footprint of a retiring coal plant under a structured multi-pollutant reduction initiative, exempt those from that block two that we talked about. That is, makes all the sense in the world to us. Another is to correct for the capacity factor that we talked about earlier by accounting for how much higher that capacity factor would have been if we had not been so proactive on wind, for instance. And it's significant. Instead of a 24% capacity factor, you'd probably be around 40 in the state. So we propose that. We propose some banking provisions, which would allow banking of early action on wind energy across about 3 years, from 2017 through 2019. So we'd love the 2005 baseline. They told us no, and essentially we designed targeted fixes to restore that. We don't know how they'll react to any of those fixes particularly. They did in a subsequent notice in November. I want to say it was in November. They basically hinted that they're looking at a 3-year baseline from 2010 to 2012, which would help the Sherco problem, but it certainly wouldn't help the full early action problem. And then you asked about offsets. I think basically, we'd love to have the flexibility. I mean, if you go back to the Waxman-Markey era and the carbon legislative era, even when the Midwest was looking at that regionally or federally. The entire utility industry wanted that flexibility to do offsets because it allows you to reach into an area where you may have more cost-effective emissions reductions. You may have co-benefits with forestry. It would be great. We're not clear that the current statute or EPA's interpretation of it will allow us to use offsets to comply with the rule. In fact, we tend to think it will not. It's not conclusive, but we're not... I'm not very bullish that I'd actually get it accepted by EPA, long story short.
Mr. Chair.
Yep, Rep. Robert. Mr. Johnson, if you want to come down and get ready to testify, and then Representative Portman.
And that's why the question was sort of aimed at maybe a joint lobbying effort at the federal level, because my understanding is the Clean Air Act really confines EPA from allowing offsets. But if there were truly sort of a bipartisan cross-sector alliance of people who wanted to seriously make progress on this offset issue, it seems like that is one issue that could unite some disparate interests to get something passed.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record, and thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Joel Johnson. I represent the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. We're made up of the 44 distribution co-ops in Minnesota and the 6 G&Ts that provide them energy. In your packets, you were given a copy of our comments that we submitted in December to the EPA on the rules. It covers a lot of the same ground that's already been covered, so I won't go through all of them, just kind of a couple of highlights. You know, we understand the complexity of the task the EPA was given, and I think from an industry perspective and from co-ops in particular, the real concern was that they were going to do this on a plant-by-plant basis, that they would set just a limit. If you were above that, you had to get below it, and if you couldn't get below it, you had to close your plant. And I think they did make an effort to make this more flexible, and we applaud that. Even on by allowing it on a state-by-state basis. What our big concerns are, though, with the rule and the way that it was set up is, number one, just the uncertainty over how this is all going to interact. I specifically mentioned, right now, FERC has the authority to regulate all the various regional transmission organizations, of which MISO is one of those.
Mr. Johnson, if you just explain what FERC is for members of the committee.
The Federal Regulatory Commission. And so we're not sure who has the ultimate authority here. Also, MISO in our region is the main organization, and that's the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator. That's the regional transmission organization that most of the state operates and most of the G&Ts operate under. Right now they have the final authority of what generation gets dispatched on any given day, and we're not sure how various state SIP plans how they're going to impact how MISO is going to incorporate those into its dispatch decisions. A good example of this, right now, all of the generation for co-ops that fall under Rule 111D are located outside of the state. So our generation and transmission organizations are working with other states in the creation of those plans. But we're not sure how the plans of, say, North Dakota and the way that they're going to be dispatching energy are going to impact the energy that we send into the state of Minnesota. So we have concerns over that. We do also share a lot of the same concerns about the legitimacy of the nature of the building blocks that the goals were based on. I won't go into all, most of those are shared with others. The one thing that we did make a comment on, I know that Minnesota was used as kind of an example for, in particular, the conservation goal. And I think, the fact that it's been successful for the most part here. But I think, this is another, particularly for the state, when they're considering how they're going to meet their state implementation, put together their state implementation plan. We think we're treating everybody fairly by treating them the same, but each of these policies has a really significant different impacts on different types of utilities. And that's based on the demographics that you serve, on the types of customers you serve, on your daily demand peaks, your need for generation or not need for new generation. So I think we need to be really careful moving forward on that. Overall concerns that we have and other concerns that really haven't been brought up at this point is, who will pay for this transformation and how will they pay? Our real concern is, and it looks like in terms of most of the discussions over state, implementation plans across the country, is that we're going to pay for this through electric rates. And from our perspective, that's probably the most regressive way that you can pay for changes in the electric sector, by using increased rates to pay for them. It also really can have a huge impact on economic competitiveness between states, and we're concerned about that. The second are the barriers to cooperation. The EPA specifically said that they would like to encourage a regional approach, but the way that the rules are set up is they've created what is something of a zero-sum game, where if you're going to cooperate, if you're going to reduce goals over here, you have to increase them over here. And it makes it very difficult to get the buy-in from all of the stakeholders.
Mr. Johnson, when you say reduce goals, you mean a higher CO2 emission level when you say that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, all right. So if you got understood.
A good example of it, and this was mentioned before, is how do you count renewable or conservation? As I mentioned before, all of our generation is located affected generation is located outside of the state. We would have real concerns if even some of the wind that we developed here in Minnesota, we weren't able to count towards our emissions in other states. And we, perfectly understand, for utilities here in Minnesota that have generation located within the state but have wind resources outside of it, they should, how are they going to be able to count that? And that kind of was the basis. And right now, the way that the wording of the plan looks is the EPA has put a fence around each state, where the fossil fuel-based generation in that state stays within that state, and the renewable stays within the state as well. So, again, and then finally, we really do think that the timetable is unworkable. These are such complicated issues that need to be settled, and so many stakeholders that need to be involved to settle them in an equitable way. Really, the most efficient approach of getting these kind of reductions from the energy sector is through the regional markets, MISO included. And, we would like to see more of an effort focused on that than what the EPA did. So. Thank you. That's all I have. I can answer any questions that members have.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any questions from members of the committee? Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to kind of go out to any of our testifiers, as I've been digging through this language here, and we've been discussing the four blocks. The fourth block, which is efficiencies, basically where we decrease demand, also been known as the tailoring rules. I've been getting conflicting stories that some of the tailoring rules were stripped or they were removed. Would you just, if you're willing to, would you just touch on what the tailoring rules are and what the status of the tailoring rules are right now?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative New, actually, I probably am not the person to answer that question.
Okay. Representative Neuberger, do you have someone, you want to phone a friend out of the audience? Or
no, I'll
see
just,
people scurrying for the exits. Or,
I'll just keep reading.
No. Okay. Representative Neuberger. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Black?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Bill Black. I'm with Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association, and I would reiterate everything that's been said here by the testifiers to this point. I think they deserve to be restated, but for sake of time, I won't. I'll try to hit a couple of issues that I think stand out as important from my perspective that may not have been emphasized as much. Number one is just that, you know, you think of the municipal utility community as being just 14% of the retail sales in Minnesota, but we're all really in this together. This is going to affect us just as much as it will Xcel and the other utilities, the co-ops and the other investor-owned utilities. So I think that we really have to get on board all together and look at this as a state together with the business community and the customers and folks on the environmental concerns, which we all have. That said, the Pollution Control Agency really has a monumental task here. They are being asked to look at things that you know, are coming at them from all directions and to make decisions about issues that traditionally have been influenced more by decisions at levels like the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, Department of Energy, Division of Energy Resources, and the Public Utilities Commission. It's really going to be an all-hands-on-deck situation, and we're going to need to really have the involvement of all the best folks and everyone looking closely at what's going on, because these issues are regulatory, but they also sort of bleed over into policy issues when you start to decide, you know, how are we going to, you know, distribute the responsibility for a lot of these responsibilities. I would just point out that all of Minnesota's early effort actions to date, and you'll see that there is a handout that I brought, and the only important, well, the only number that I want to point out there is at the very bottom right is that since 2005, Minnesota's reduced CO2 emissions, the electric power industry has reduced emissions by about, this says 27%, but that doesn't factor in that Sherco was offline in 2012. So really we're looking at more like 15, maybe 20%, and that's not going to count toward our 41% goal. And I don't know how much of what we do between 2012 and 2020 is going to count. So those are real issues with the early action, and again, like the other testifiers, I don't have the solution to that. There's good ideas out there, but I think we need to look at them and really be aware that we're nowhere near where we need to be in understanding how this rule is going to affect us if it doesn't get fixed. And I looked real quickly to see what our neighboring states' requirements are, and I can list real quickly for you that North Dakota has an 11% reduction. I actually sent this to the committee administrator to the link to a map that is the EPA's, and it could be distributed. But South Dakota's at 35%, Iowa 16%, Wisconsin 34%, Illinois 33%, Nebraska 26%, Montana 21%, Wyoming 19%, and Minnesota has the 10th highest reduction amount, the 10th most restrictive at 41%. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the time. I think this will be an ongoing discussion. We hope to stay engaged.
Thank you. Any questions from members of the committee? Quick question. From your perspective, of your organization's perspective, do you prefer a state implementation plan or a federal implementation plan?
Mr. Chair, I think we need to look at the option of a regional implementation plan. We would love to get our neighbors to work with us because we've got, especially on the municipal side, we've got entities that work in across state lines. We've got generation, coal and renewable in Wyoming, North Dakota, Iowa, Wisconsin. We need to figure this out, and it would probably be very helpful if we could get our neighbors to join with us.
Thank you, Mr. Black. Appreciate your testimony. Mr. Arata. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Arada, and I'm here on behalf of the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't have to equivocate where we are on this plan. We are against it. Our only goal in life at this point is to defeat it. We don't think that the EPA has the legal authority in any way, shape, or form to do what they're doing, and the Supreme Court has warned them about overreaches, and they did so in quite strong words last July. And let's be clear, the Clean Power Plan is energy policy. This is not environmental policy. And I guess I would ask the committee, as policymakers, are you comfortable with the EPA and with state departments deciding what the energy policy for the state of Minnesota is going to be, or should that be at least partially in hands of bodies that are deliberative and represent the people of the state and should be the ones setting energy policy? There is so much to be said, and there's no way I can get close to saying everything I'd like to today. You heard comments about a one-year extension. How do we get this done? A normal SIP, states have 2 to 3 years potentially to do that. I don't believe that any state is likely to meet the deadline. They're going to have less than a year once the plan is finalized. And think back to last summer. All the states were given, I believe, 60 extra days to submit just their comments. There were a few states around the country that said, oh, no, we're done. I mean, the notice of the comment deadline being extended only came a matter of days before the original deadline. And almost without exception, every state took advantage of all those 60 days to turn plans in. I can't imagine they're going to do any less with a SIP that, oh, by the way, will be legally enforceable once that's turned in and potentially accepted by the EPA. The range of reductions range, and you've heard some of it, the high is 72% in Washington and North Dakota at a low of 11%. So there are very different impacts around the country. It's also interesting, I know the EPA talked about they're going to be mindful of cost and reliability. I swear, if I did not know that was the PCA talking, I thought it was a regulatory commissioner or a body talking. The EPA continues to sell this as an environmental plan, yet when you go around the country state to state, and I have been in many of them as I cover 12 and I travel to others, the interesting thing is all of the environmental departments, I think almost without exception that I've talked to, have said, boy, we're talking to people we didn't know existed before. We didn't know what jobs they did before because they are all of a sudden talking to regulators, not environmental people. And so you have agencies, environmental departments that are being thrown into this pond of regulating power in their states and making decisions. And it's something that they've never done before. They've never been required. I'm going to try to cut the comments down significantly because I know of time shortness. But the Southwest Power Pool, and I know I handed out a couple of handouts to the committee. One is on energy costs in Minnesota's numbers, because energy costs matter, and they matter a lot, of course, to low-income and fixed-income people. The other one is a paper that ACE just produced on reliability concerns. In particular, if you like, look on page 2, you see the amount of coal capacity that will be retired, and that goes to reliability. You also see that NERC has identified ERCOT, which is down in the Texas area, and MISO, the Midwest region, as being very at risk for not having generation to supply the needs. And that's the interesting thing here, is everybody talks about the goal being 2030, yet for most states, as it's said here, 38% of 41% for Minnesota will have to be met by 2020. And that's not unusual for most of these states. So imagine in 5 years you see all this power, you know, many gigawatts of power that is no longer going to be available. How do you replace that in 5 years? Maybe the utilities in the room have a plan on how they can do that, but I doubt that it's possible. And that's why a lot of reliability entities around the country have raised concerns. But I wanted to point out, because I wanted to focus my comments somewhat on reliability, a little bit on the interplay and who actually has authority in the states to do this. And then a little bit about the legal authority of EPA. But Southwest Power Pool Regional State Committee said, EPA inadequately considers electric transmission facilities in establishing the timeline for interim goals in their draft, that the energy efficiency assumptions relied upon by the Clean Power Plan are unrealistic and not sustainable, that the Clean Power Plan's utilization of 70% capacity factor for combined cycle units is unsound, that the CPP's failure to consider the availability of materials and labor for constructing the electric transmission and generation infrastructure required to comply with the rule, and in the short time frame to meet interim goals, risk reliability in the bulk electric system. Now, this is a regional reliability organization whose job is to make sure we have power when we need it. So they are simply looking at the plan and trying to figure out how are we going to implement it and what the flaws are. And so as they have expressed very serious concerns, so have others. I would suggest that these same principles apply in the MISO region, and you may want to talk to MISO about what the potential impacts could be on Minnesota. With regard to building block one inside the fence regulation, that typically would fall, I think, under the authority of the Pollution Control Agency. And you heard about the 6%. You've heard about flexibility. I think that the EPA believes that if they say the word flexibility long enough, it will become true. I don't believe that that's the case. If you go through the four building blocks, building block one, 6% efficiency increase. I have talked to literally a dozen plus utilities around the country. Some of them are members, others not are members. They all, quite frankly, laugh at the ability to do 6%. Utilities have been doing efficiency improvements for decades because it makes sense. The realistic number that I keep hearing is one, if they could get 2%, they would be doing really, really well. And so when you talk about flexibility, if you throw that assumption out, and once again, the EPA is making many, many broad assumptions here that don't hold water. If you throw that 6% assumption out, and the EPA has already calculated state by state how much wind you will or renewables you will need, how much you will have to reduce coal, how much you will have to ramp up gas to meet this megawatt hour goal. They call it a goal, yet it really is a mandate. It's not a goal. If you don't meet it, it will be part of a SIP and once again legally enforceable. So it's simply not a goal. But if you don't make that 6%, you're going to have to find somewhere else to make up some of that 4 or 5%. People have talked about the 70% and how that's probably not attainable. That's a standard, once again, applied across the country. I would suggest you talk to the utilities in the state and say, how many plants do we have in that category, and are you going to be able to run them at 70%? It's a little hard to chase wind and at the same time have that gas plant being baseload generation. There are also strong questions about the availability and timeliness of gas to supply. The infrastructure is not in place. Once again, this needs to happen in 5 years, and so there's not a lot of time to make that determination. Building block three, and when we talk about renewable energy development, and building block four, energy efficiency, particularly in building block four, you know, as I said, the Southwest Power Pool has said that 1.5% energy efficiency year after year is not realistic. But another underlying assumption that people don't know about either is on the demand side, the EPA has calculated in their plan that between now and 2030, Americans will use 10% less power than they do today normal business as usual compared to where we would be on 2030. They're saying, they're putting in an assumption that we will decrease that amount by 10%. Now, they haven't factored in 3 million more people in the country, and they haven't factored in, hopefully, more economic growth. And so, as Paul Harvey would say, that's some of the rest of the story. Some of the things that you don't hear about, you don't know about, that hurt that ability to be flexible. If you can't run gas plants 70% of the time, where are you going to make the power up? If you can't get credit, and a lot of states have the same issues as Minnesota, no credit for early action. You heard about Sherco and the fact that wasn't running, so that's a fly in the ointment for the state of Minnesota. Lots of states have specific issues like that. Every state is unique, and so they're all saying the same thing to the EPA. In South Dakota, they're saying, we have one gas plant and one coal plant, and that's it. You know, if you're going to force us to deal with issues at our coal plant, then where do we turn? So we'll see what happens when we get into the real work of putting this thing together. I would suggest it's going to be messy at best. But part of the questions you need to be asking, and that every state has to be asking, is who has the authority? You know, is it the PUC? is that the PCA, who has the authority to go out and tell utilities, you're going to do this much energy efficiency, you're going to do this much in renewables in the state? That's something that, that typically has been the authority of the utility commissions. And what if they're not a regulated utility? Somehow all these questions that aren't being talked about yet are really going to have to be answered as to who has the authority to make these decisions and have them be enforceable. And oh, by the way, if you turn in those kinds of requirements on behalf of your state and a SIP to the EPA, how will they look at that? How will they determine we can accept a plan whose aspects are not enforceable by the state law of the state that are turning them in? It's going to get very messy before it gets over, and we all know it's going to end up in a legal battle. And so once this plan, once this rule is finalized sometime this summer, the lawsuits will come quickly, at least as quickly as all the attorneys can get everything written up, and then we'll be into the legal fight. So the CPP, the Clean Power Proposal, it's the type of results-driven regulation we think where an agency creatively interprets statutory authority, and then the courts have routinely overruled these kinds of things. The proposal suffers from two threshold legal flaws. First, does EPA have authority to regulate CO2 emissions from coal-generating electric units? And second, if they do have the authority, it lacks authority to direct states, to states, the level of emission reductions that each state must make. Beyond these basic flaws, the legal infirmities of EPA's 645-page proposal and about another 1,000 pages of supporting documents are just too numerous to summarize. There are going to be legal challenges on a lot of bases here. But one fault kind of predominates, and that is EPA is requiring states to submit plans that essentially re-engineer their electric utility systems, and they don't have the power to do this. EPA is acting under Section 111, as you have heard. Section 111 says they can create a list of categories of stationary sources that emit pollutants or cause significantly contribute to the public health or welfare danger, so the endangerment finding that this all started with based on automobiles. Under Section 111B, they promulgated performance standards to apply to new facilities within a source category. And for certain types of facilities and pollutants, EPA under Section 111D can call on states to submit plans under which the state establishes the performance standards for existing sources. So 111D has been rarely used, and never have they gone in 40 years outside the fence line. It's always been on specific controls at a power plant to control for a criteria pollutant. The Clean Air Act was never set up to regulate CO2, and that's why it's going to be so messy legally. Traditional pollutants under the Clean Air Act tend to be local or regional, predominantly in nature. You can put technology on a plant, you can control for SO2 emissions, you can take care of acid rain and acid in the water issues, other types of things, particulate matter. But the Clean Air Act was set under that kind of a regulatory environment and thought. It was not set up for an emission from a power plant that truly is global in nature and simply goes into the atmosphere and can't be controlled on a more regional or a more local as a source. So the EPA proposal to control CO2 emissions from existing coal fuel generators, it's nothing like EPA has ever proposed before. And although EPA says states would be free to formulate their own plans to meet the goals, one thing is clear, no state could achieve these goals through technological or operating improvements at facilities at a source category, which is what Section 111 talks about. Instead, any state plan would inevitably require wholesale changes to how state utilities provide electricity to the public. Simply put, the EPA does not have the power to dictate to states how to run their electric systems. So this proposal directly inserts the agency into matters that are reserved for state regulation. States, through their public service commissions, have exclusive authority over electric resource planning. Not even FERC, much less the EPA, has the authority to dictate electric resources choices to states. And the notion that Congress authorized EPA through Section 111 to mandate that states restructure their electric systems is far-fetched and not credible. Thank you for your time and attention, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Mr. Arata. Mr. Gerber, if you want to come down, Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rather than asking the testifier if he's ever heard of the Clean Air Act or the United States Supreme Court, I thought I would ask you, since we've clearly left the part of this hearing where we're receiving unbiased information to inform us, whether you intended to give proponents of the rule and its merits equal time.
Yeah, I will. That's fine. Any other questions from members of the committee? Mr. Arata, thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. It's always good to see a former state senator over here in the House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm surprised the House was going to make it this easy on me today.
So am I. Mr. Gerber, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. And in fairness, Representative Hortman, we should have a proponent come down if self-select from the committee. We'll definitely be having future committee hearings on this as well, Representative Hortman, so however people want to address it. So, Representative Mr. Gerber.
I haven't won an election, so.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for having me here today. I just wanted to start out as the only ratepayer representative, I think, presenting today, unless someone else comes up after. I wanted to emphasize the importance that energy rates played to my members. We represented over 2,300 members across the state of Minnesota. Minnesota is now 31st as of 2012 in industrial rates. That's a huge decline. We used to be in the top 20 and then in the top 25, and now we are number 31. Since 2004, our energy rates across the state have gone up over 57%. But in northern Minnesota, where we have some of our most price-sensitive customers, they've gone up since 2005 over 60%. And I think I wanted to address one of the questions a member had asked about MERP and whether MERP was really just for particulate matter. And actually, I looked up some of the documents while other people were testifying. CO2 was specifically called out by the PCA and included in the analysis over MERP. And just to talk about the costs and the investments that we aren't counting towards this, XL ratepayers alone have paid $600 million to retrofit as part of the MERP project. The chamber played a role in some of those negotiations. I believe in the end we ended up supporting the MERP project. So I'm not here to criticize the program, but what's really important, what I'm here to emphasize, is the importance of 111D and the impact on the business community and ratepayers in general. And so we already have investments over $600 million, and most of that will not count, those investments that did offset CO2. And one of the things that I think is frustrating as I look at this from ratepayers is a lot of the discussion, again, before my time, but my understanding was premised on if Minnesota is an early adopter or we do things first, and we have a history of wanting to be in the lead in these things, but then we don't get credit for it, I think that is very concerning to the business community as well as the people that are paying and having these decisions put into our rates. I do want to go back and thank the MPCA. They have had a lot of stakeholder meetings, and they have listened to concerns, and I do appreciate that. And it's sincerely that they have listened to the business community and hoping that they continue to listen to us as we go through this. I do want to emphasize, again, the importance, the critical importance that competitive energy rates play. As you see, as we lose competitiveness, specifically in the industrial side, commercial rates are a problem, too. But commercial customers tend to be their cost of doing business when you look at energy is a lot smaller than those industrial customers. We have industrial customers in our state that pay over $1 million a month just in energy alone. That cost exceeds their cost of labor, so it's of huge importance. The other concern that we wrote about, and I believe there's a letter in your packet, is shifting the risk to the natural gas market. One of the things with that 111D and some of the plans are the suggestion that we start running our natural gas plants at a higher capacity. The problem with that is it puts a lot of eggs into the natural gas market that I'm not sure we really want to do. As natural gas prices are volatile, thankfully they're really low right now. That's been a huge blessing to the business community and to consumers everywhere, as well as residential customers. But there is that fear that relying just on natural gas alone could create a huge issue. And I think regardless of politics, whether you support the rule or not, I think it's important to realize the huge implications that the state's decisions are going to have on our future energy policy, and that's really what I want to emphasize. Whether you support it, again, or deny it, or support it or you oppose it, you have to consider that these are huge changes in the way that the state does energy policy. And we think that it's important as legislators that you think about the consumers, the ratepayers, as well as the utilities, who are important businesses. Having a healthy utility is essential to having a healthy business climate in the state as well. So I think it's really important, again, to think about these, be deliberate, and also really pay attention to the decisions that the PCA is making, the governor's office, and other members of the executive branch are making.
Thank you, Mr. Gerber. Representative Baker, and if Mr. Hamilton from Fresh Energy wants to come on down to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I have a question back to Mr. Thornton. If he could come up for a question, please.
Well, I think
I'll cherish this moment forever.
He says, he's Representative Mahoney.
Can I get a tape recorder out?
Representative Mahoney and Mr. Gerber, I think in the public comment portions that were submitted from Minnesota, there was overwhelming consensus that the MPCA submitted for Minnesotans that we should get early adoption, not just for the good work we did, but also going forward. It would actually provide a significant disincentive for our state to ever do anything in the areas of energy or environmental policy without the federal government mandating it. So I haven't met anyone in Minnesota who is in dispute on that. If they are, they can talk to me after the committee, but I'm not aware of any stakeholders who think that that we should not get that. So that's nice of you. So you asked for Mr. Thornton?
Yes.
Welcome back, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Thornton, for just another question. I was able to take some more notes as the other testifiers here were kind of explaining their journey, their challenges for us to be competitive. And I do want to also thank you as Mr. Gerber had suggested, you've had a lot of good meetings with the stakeholders, and thank you for that. Hearing Minnesota's 41% number that the EPA is suggesting, and then again comparing that to Iowa at 16%, North Dakota 11%. I mean, we're so much different with that. Do you think that the co-ops idea of moving this towards the more of an independent system operators model would work better versus a state footprint, just because it seems more fair shared in that concept? I just wanted to get your read on that, if you feel that that would seem more reasonable from a regional standpoint versus a state footprint.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think it's, well, it's not real, nothing's clear in this, but I think it's very likely that operating an implementation plan that includes multiple states, particularly multiple states that are within either the MISO footprint or that our utilities, have footprints in, like North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, is going to be an approach that could cost much less than each state going it alone. I think the challenge is finding those other states that want to talk about that. And I'm encouraged by some of the things I've heard today. I think it's going to take the utilities and some of those. I mean, we've been very upfront about our willingness to talk to other states. I think the utilities and some of our neighboring states need to encourage them to step up and come talk to us.
And just to follow up, if I could, Mr. Chair, and I hope the MPCA really fights for that. I think you are saying the right things, but I hope that it's a real economic issue for us. We all believe in the clean air, clean water stuff. So I hope that you, in a way, do your best to cut some teeth and to really try to get something done here, because we rely on the MPCA to fight for us when it comes to these environmental issues. But I really hope that the MPCA steps up and really is leader on this when it comes to the Upper Midwest. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Hamilton, please. Thank you very much for your testimony, Commissioner.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. How much time do I have as a proponent?
Well, we're at the committee adjournment time, but I do want to give you an opportunity to present what you think would be relevant to the committee.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. My name is J. Drake Hamilton, the
mistakes get made all the time when your nickname is Jay. And I'm with Fresh Energy. I serve as the science policy director. And I've been involved in the stakeholder process that not only the Pollution Control Agency, but also the Department of Commerce has put together over the last 2 years. I've never seen a more transparent process bringing together everyone who wants to be at the table, because we all have a stake in this going forward, to figure out how Minnesota in a smart way is going to meet the Clean Power Plan. Here's what I especially like about the Clean Power Plan. It has carbon reduction goals that make sense for Minnesota, and it builds on what Minnesota has already achieved, our utilities have already achieved, for other reasons, including jobs, reducing fossil fuel imports so that we're relying on fuels that are located within the state of Minnesota, like Minnesota, like wind, solar, and energy efficiency, and ground source heating, moving forward with those technologies that are native to Minnesota. It's been said, and I think it's really true, the great value of this next stage in the Clean Power Plan is the states are in the driver's seat. And so as Minnesota, being a smart state with lots of facilities, lots of great utilities and businesses who are smart about our use of energy and have always been proactive about moving forward in a way that's best for our state's economy and for our water and air, I think the fact that we have a stakeholder process in place led by the PCA and Department of Commerce, where anyone can participate, where there are robust conversations, and a lot of those conversations are with MISO present, all of them. MISO's been present at every single meeting, because reliability and cost are the two top considerations of everyone in the group, according to the polling that was done on February 20th. So we're all about cost and reliability. And now it's the time for Minnesota to develop a plan that will achieve the goals and achieve other goals that we have in Minnesota. So keeping the cost low, we have lots of experience here in the legislature with least cost planning, and we've been on a clean energy path in Minnesota since 2007, and we're seeing results in terms of the tax base in counties all across Minnesota and development of clean energy jobs all across Minnesota. And so we can continue to build on that. As Mr. Thornton said, looking at that building block three, which assumes wrongly that Minnesota is at the regional average of renewable energy, just 15%, we're already above that, and it's only 2014. Those numbers were 2014 numbers. And so we can invest in those building blocks that we know are good for the Minnesota economy, and as well energy efficiency. And what we'll see is that we're going to maximize other things like economic growth in Minnesota, and at the same time cut carbon. And so that's our challenge, and we welcome the process going forward, because we think Minnesota has already shown the way and shown great leadership and developed our great potential, started to develop our great potential, and we're going to be building on that in the next couple of decades.
Thank you. Any questions from members of the committee? Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this might not be a fair question for you because I know you're a scientist, not an attorney, but do you believe that the EPA has the legal authority to implement Section 111D?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in fact, the Supreme Court has ruled that the Environmental Protection Agency has no alternative but to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from existing coal burning and other fossil fuel power plants, that it is the obligation under the Clean Air Act because carbon dioxide damages human health and welfare. So the other interesting thing to remember about the Clean Air Act that we've been using now for 45 years in this country, and it was approved in 1990 with a vote of 10 of the 10 members of the Minnesota's congressional delegation led by Senator Dave Durenberger, because he was noting the great benefits for human health and welfare. It's all about people.
Any other additional questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, obviously, members, the 111D implementation plan is a huge, huge deal with significant impacts, not only in the nation, but it stretches to all corners of the state of Minnesota, and it's something that members would be wise to have a better understanding of and what role we will play in that. With that, we are adjourned.